I would like to do is introduce or give an overview of a number of problems in the healthcare system that I think raise important moral issues. But the issues I want to raise are not the issues that we typically think of in medicine as raising moral issues. The ones we typically think of as raising moral issues are, I think, what we would usually call the more individual physician, individual patient, or family questions. Choices about when to die, for example, perhaps abortion, et cetera. They're not the larger system questions. The questions I'd like to raise for the series for the week, and each day will be self-contained, so no one will be dependent on the previous one, but they will be related. The questions I want to raise in the whole series are what I would call the more political questions about the healthcare system. They are the questions that today a lot of economists are talking about because of the particularly aggravating problem of costs, rising costs within the healthcare sector of the economy. Forgive me if I fall into language like sector of the economy once in a while, but it's just the terms in which everything is written about this problem. I think we know what it means. The first day today will be an overview, and I want to raise what I think is one of the important conceptual and moral questions that underlies an overview of the problem of rising medical costs, which is the price of life. And I want to deal very specifically with some proposals about how to price lives, as offensive as that may seem to people. Tomorrow, I want to deal with a particular dilemma in the allocation of resources for medical care, the dilemma between spending a lot of money on prevention or spending it on cure and care for people who already have a problem. Assuming finite resources in the healthcare system, that dilemma will arise. There's no way to get around it. Only if we spent all that could be spent on healthcare would we not have that dilemma. A lot of people these days are proposing that our healthcare system is very wasteful because it treats first the problems that have already hit people instead of emphasizing prevention. And that's one of the reasons we've gotten into escalating medical costs. I want to say that case is partially plausible, but I want to argue that there is a moral case for spending more on cure and care than on prevention, despite the fact that that will, in the end, save less lives. That may not appear to you a plausible case now, but I'll try to make that tomorrow. On Wednesday, I want to deal with the question of the form that medical care should take for the poor. There are a number of important options in our present society, in the present political discussion, not only Medicaid, the program we presently have, but what's called a voucher system, which I'll explain then. And what I want to throw in is the claim that both of those are wrong, or at least I want to argue for purposes of discussion, because I think it raises an important issue, that both of those are wrong and that instead we should have no special health care program for the poor at all. If we have anything, which I think we should have income maintenance, not a special health care program for the poor. Then on Thursday, I want to get to the question of doctors' incomes. That's the problem where medical costs hit most of us in our daily dealings with the healthcare system. And I want to look at what doctors' income levels are. I want to ask whether they're justified. And my own conclusions on this were rather surprising to myself. Well, I won't tell you what they are at this point. Okay. From 1950 to 1980, healthcare expenses rose dramatically. Even in terms of relative percentage of the economic resources of the country spent on them, it's not just if you look at the absolute, at the dollars, and it's not just if you look at the dollars discounted for inflation. So you're really talking about real dollars. If you look at those dollars in non-discounted, not discounted for inflation dollars. A hospital room in 1950 cost $19 a day. A hospital room now on the average costs $242 a day. That's just a regular bed. That's not intensive care. That's absolutely nothing added. And if you discount for inflation, still it comes out that a hospital bed today costs three times what in a regular unit costs three times. It's even more than this in the intensive care units. Costs three times what it cost in 1950 in real dollars. In terms of the whole economy, we spent 5% of our gross national product in 1950 on health care. We now spend 10%. If you discount for population changes, mainly age changes, a higher proportion of our people now are older. If you discount for that, the increase is still something like from 5 to 8.5. It's still almost double. It's still a marked increase in the percentage of our gross national product. And of course, our gross national product has grown also. Doctors' incomes, the head people in the healthcare sector, have risen twice as fast as the average person's income between 1940 and 1980. That may be interesting. But that is only indicative. It's actually a slower rise than the rise of total resources we have spent relative to the rest of the economy that we have spent on healthcare. Now, one of the things that has contributed to that rise is not just the inefficiencies you might see in the healthcare system. There are, to be sure, I'm convinced, many inefficiencies, and they are largely generated by insurance, which removes any incentive to cut out inefficiencies. But I'll get to that later. But one of the reasons the healthcare costs have risen is simply that we're getting better healthcare. New technological procedures, new treatments of various sorts. And the question that then that raises is, does life have a price? What is healthcare worth? If a particular procedure stands only a certain amount of chance of improving your welfare, and it's going to cost a certain amount of money, and ahead of time you know that as a society, should you spend the money on it? To take an example, a very specific example which may seem very, very trivial, but it is, I think, symbolic. Pardon me, Dave, you've heard this one before. There is a 6-series test for intestinal cancer. It's done on stools, on feces, and the 6-series test was devised without much thought about the costs of having a 6-series test instead of a 3-series test. You could do 3 of these little tests. They're relatively similar tests on a given, one specific stool specimen from a given individual to test for cancer. You could have just a 3-series test. It would catch fewer of the cancer cases than the 6-series test. But if you look at the marginal benefits, how much extra money does it cost in our whole healthcare economy to have a 4-series test instead of a 3-series test? It turns out that the 4th test in the series, overall, in our healthcare system, turns out, in terms of the number of lives it saves, you pick up a certain amount of cancer cases and only a certain percentage of those are curable that you do pick up, it turns out that that 4th test, instead of just having a 3-series test, a 3-test series, excuse me, costs $1.5 million per life saved. The 5th test in the series, instead of just having a 4-test series, costs $12 million per life saved. And the 6th test in the series turns out to cost $141 million per life saved. And yet, in our healthcare system, nobody asked whether or not we should have a 3-series, a 3-test series, a 4-test series, a 5-test series, or a 6-test series. Now, these don't cost much, you know, it's only maybe $25 for the whole series. When you total it up, that's what the amount of money is that we're spending on saving a life by having a 6-test series instead of a 5-test series or whatever particular increment you're talking about. And then the obvious question is, should we be spending that kind of money when there's a need to spend that money on other things in our society? Good or bad things. I mean, all kinds of things that people want. It might be on ice cream cones or bottles of wine, or it could be on some program that might strike people as even more urgent. But in our healthcare economy, the question of whether to have that 6-test series instead of a 3-test series doesn't even get raised. The reason it doesn't get raised is nobody has an incentive within the system to have a 3-test series and save the money and use it on other things than healthcare instead of having a 6-test series. And one of those reasons is that we're all insured. Now, I'll get to the insurance business, as I said, in a little more detail later. Let me note one of the other disturbing questions about this whole rise in medical costs. Not only does it raise the question that I've been mentioning, are the improvements in the care worth the money, which I'll generally call the question of cost-worthy care. Is the improved care, the marginally better care, worth the money? Given, by definition, the fact that money is something we could use on other things. Money, by definition, is that which you can use for trading on other things. So there's that question of cost-worthy care. There's another very important question. It's the redistributive question. Anytime one sector of the economy grows in relation to others, some people gain and other people lose. And what the fact that we're spending 10% of our gross national product, almost 10, on health care, compared to 5% in 1950, means is that the people who work in the healthcare sector or the people who in some other way get benefits from the healthcare sector are gaining. And the people who don't might not have jobs because we are putting that money into the healthcare sector, or they're just having other things done with the money, the things that they might rather have sacrificed in favor of other things. So it's a redistributive question. It's a question of who gains. And that fundamentally is a question of justice. Now, we wouldn't worry about that if everybody freely traded things, everybody freely made the decision to spend a certain amount of money on healthcare, and out of that it came to be that we now spend 10% of our GNP on healthcare, and in 1950 we spent only 5%. Because you'd say, well, the people made those free decisions, apparently, and they made it with some knowledge, that apparently that's what they want. And that's a free economy, and there's no question of justice to be raised. What I'll try to point out is that it's certainly not that simple. Free market doesn't work very well, or hasn't worked very well with healthcare. Let me get today, first of all, to the question of the causes of the rise in medical costs. I've only just very briefly highlighted a few. It's important to understand them in more detail, understand some other ones. The other thing I want to do is briefly review the price of life debate. I'll do the former, the causes first, and then I'll get out of that to the price of life discussion. First, the causes of the rise in medical costs. The first and foremost that almost everybody agrees on is insurance. 93% of the costs of healthcare are covered today by insurance. Only 7% come out of pocket. Now, as soon as you're insured, neither you nor the provider have any incentive whatsoever to keep, you don't have much incentive, you don't have any of the previous incentive, to forego a procedure, or forego an office visit, or forego anything in the healthcare delivery system, because it's not worth the money. The only time you'll forego it is if it doesn't do any good. But that's not the question that we're concerned about. We could be spending 80% of our GNP on healthcare, in a couple centuries at least, after some more technological developments, if the only question we ask was, does the care we're getting improve our health? But that's not the question. The question is it worth the money, given the other things we want to do with it? And insurance just simply removes that question immediately for the individual patient and the individual provider. The provider may never have had an incentive to ask that question, except indirectly through the patient's interest in asking that question. Namely, if the patient wants to cut down on the cost of medical care or does ask the question, is this worth the money, the patient might then not pay the bill. And then the provider is out some money. So indirectly, the provider has an incentive in a non-insured system in keeping the care within the bounds of costly care. But once you get insurance, you don't have that incentive. Now you might say, well, you would have that incentive if every time a patient went to a physician, even though the chances of needing that visit were not very high, or any time you went into the hospital, or any time you were in a hospital and added 3 days to the visit, or whatever the increment is that you're talking about in care, the patient, right the very next day, got a bill for the increase in premium that was caused by that incremental care. Now, suppose you did that. You still wouldn't give the patients much incentive to cut down on non-cost-worthy care. The reason you wouldn't is that the pool of people paying the premiums is much, much larger than the pool of patients. And so the costs don't come back to the patients alone, they come back to people in general in the premium pool. Now what that means, and the very, very bothersome question it raises is, I don't want to ask the question in a loaded way, I just want to ask it as an open question. But I don't think we've been asking it as an open question. We haven't been asking it much at all. In that kind of system, aren't the ill taking a free ride on the well? Because they don't have to pay for the decisions they make about what care is worth the money. So, of course, they won't ask the question, what care is worth the money? They'll only ask, will this care do me some good, regardless of how much money it costs? Because they can spread the cost out over a large pool of people, not just themselves. Now, if, of course, all the other people over whom the costs are spread agree that the cost is worth the money, that that care is worth the money, then there's no problem. If, in fact, all the well really do feel that they should pick up the tab for all the even very slightly beneficial and very expensive items of health care that a particular ill person and provider might want, it usually, in fact, comes at the suggestion of the provider, then we might not be bothered. But, of course, people paying insurance premiums these days are getting bothered, because the premium for the average premium in the United States for a family of four for comprehensive coverage involving at most $100 deductible per person within the family is now, this is the average, it may not be as high in your area, it isn't in general as high on the West Coast, is $1,440 per year. If you, now that's being fairly conservative because of the, that works out to about $130 a year, a month for a family of four. And that's exactly about, I mean, you look at what's being deducted from the paycheck if the employer is deducting it, or what the employer has contributed, even if he's just contributing it as a fringe benefit or whatever, and that's pretty typical for a family of four. And the question then comes up, is that worth it? Now, some economists have computed how much they think, it's a very, very questionable computation, but it's fascinating how they've tried to do it. They've tried to compute the extra care that insurance, jumping from a relatively uninsured system 30 years ago to a very highly insured system now, disregarding other factors, what the insurance business contributed to the rise of healthcare. And then they ask whether or not the welfare gain from insurance, just the economic security, the security in knowing that you're not going to cheat on healthcare if you do get in trouble because of a financial bind then, I mean, there are lots of benefits from insurance. They try to ascertain what the value of the insurance is to individuals and what the costs are that insurance has created. And some economists, namely one named Feldstein at Harvard, came out with a striking conclusion back in 1973 that the move from a relatively, the move from a moderately insured economy in which 50% of costs were insured to a moderately highly insured economy in which 80% of costs were insured, which is not even as high as we're present yet, but just that moderate jump from 50% to 80% actually created a welfare loss. Now, as I said, this is controversial how you would compute that. But their claim is, some economists' claim is, that the extra and relatively, I don't want to say useless, I say relatively useless, because it's slightly beneficial, but it's very expensive when you compute it out for the whole. The relatively useless care generated by insurance outweighs the value of the increased insurance, the security. That's possible. It's very hard to claim that that's actually the case, but we should clearly see it as a possibility. Now, in light of all those problems, what would you do? Give up insurance? No, I mean, we don't want to go back to the day when we weren't insured. Unless we had big, each all had big savings accounts or something like that. And even that wouldn't solve the problem. And you can get wiped out with a $500,000 bill in no time with a serious health crisis. So what do we do? Well, some have suggested we band together and form, I'll use this term very loosely here, prepaid plans or some kind of arrangement in which we're not going to leave it up to the individual patient and the individual provider to decide what care is going to be delivered. Since once you're insured, there aren't any incentives in that system to hold back, restrain yourself in using care. What we're going to do is select providers, for example, and give them guidelines on the basis of which they just will say, in certain cases, well, no, you won't get this care. In most cases, the patient won't even know that that care is a possibility, so the question won't even be raised. But in talking to a neighbor, maybe they find out that, well, so-and-so in a certain situation did get a CAT scan, but they didn't. So they go to their physician and say, hey, shouldn't I get a CAT scan in this case? Well, that's $500 a whack. The physician says, no, you don't fit the guidelines for who's eligible for a CAT scan in this plan, in this prepaid plan that I'm working for. Some of those are called health maintenance organizations, some are called other sorts of plans. What that is the people, what kind of arrangement that is the people who buy the plan, who buy the premium, saying ahead of time, we're concerned about costs, so we're going to give the providers and the plan the authority to restrain the delivery of care when they think that it's not worth the money. Now, obviously, there's a risk in that because they might have different ideas about what's worth the money than we have. But the point is, don't you see that with the problem of rising medical costs, it is very plausible indeed for people to sign up with a plan that is going to restrain care. And if people who sign up for that plan then later say, oh, this plan isn't very good because it didn't give me a CAT scan in this particular case. No, that's not the way people should think about those plans. It is precisely the fact that a plan does get hard-headed and say, we won't deliver this particular care in this particular case. It's precisely when a plan does that that the plan is meeting the desire of people who sign up for the plan to restrain costs. So if you're in a prepaid, so if you've got a neighbor who's in a prepaid plan and you're in a non-prepaid plan, and the neighbor says, oh, we couldn't get the kind of care that so-and-so got, and you got that care, don't say, oh, that's a lousy plan, they're not giving the best medical care. Sure, they're not giving the best medical care. That's the point. If we gave the best possible medical care over a period of time, we'd exhaust our resources. As one commentator has put it, the best possible medical care system is a monster. It's as much of a monster as the best possible defense department. Now, that doesn't mean that prepaid plans might not, at times, make very foolish and wrong decisions about when to restrain care. So I don't want to remove subscribers' criticisms on the restrictions in a plan. But if there are no restrictions, why sign up for a prepaid plan? The cost of any prepaid plan is you don't have complete choice of physician within the community. But the benefit is the restraint of costs, hopefully. Other things too. I'm leaving out a whole bunch of other considerations in the choice of plans here. Insurance is one cause of the rise in healthcare premiums and healthcare costs. One of the ways to get around it is for people to band together ahead of time and give providers the authority to restrain costs. Whether that will work, it hasn't worked very well in our economy. It's worked to some extent in some communities, economists tell us. Prepaid plans are saving about 40% on the total bill. But those calculations are very much in dispute, and it may be that they're getting healthier people in the plan. There are a lot of disputes about those figures. And in any case, what any prepaid plan in our society is going to feel pressured to do is to provide all the care that all the other delivery force plans are providing in order to maintain a great reputation in the community for giving really good medical care. There's going to be that pressure on any prepaid plan. Now my vision, by the way, or one vision here, I'm not sure it's mine, in a sense it's mine, is that when you get to the level of poor people, the need to restrain the cost of healthcare is even more urgent. So what poor people would most want to do is to band together and get a bunch of providers to give them healthcare who were going to be extremely cost-conscious, so that their premiums would only be $60 a month instead of $120 a month. Assuming they were paying for it, that's the whole question, what the form of the aid should be. Assuming they were getting either through their own resources or from government cash assistance, they were paying for it. What they would want to do is have an extremely cost-conscious, extremely hard-headed, extremely restraining plan, because that would save them what they so much need for other needs, for other things in their life. So it is precisely at the point where plans, prepaid plans, health maintenance organizations, et cetera, adopt explicitly what we might call low-style healthcare systems. Explicitly say, we're not going to buy into this new development or this particular way of delivering care or this kind of hospital, et cetera, because it's too expensive. It's not worth the money. It's precise that the more they do that, the more they are taking upon themselves the perspective of the poor. And what I would argue is in our society, prepaid plans haven't done it nearly enough. They've done it only enough to meet the perspective of the middle class. They have not done it to meet the perspective of the poor. But that's because of a whole bunch of other incentives in the system. Well, enough on insurance. Another contributing factor is the way insurers pay medical bills. If you look at the way insurers pay for hospital bills, they do it on a cost reimbursement basis. The hospital sends in to the insurer every year, a couple of years, an accounting tally about what the total hospital costs are and how they do in fact compute up to $241 a day for just an ordinary bed day. And then the insurance company says, okay, $241 is a legitimate rate, and they pay it. Well, that gives the hospital absolutely no incentive to move that $241 down to $220. It gives them no incentive not to float it up to $281 if they want to. It's open ended. Cost reimbursement is one thing that's contributed to it. Another thing that people don't realize is that tax breaks have contributed to it. When an employer pays your premium, it's not taxable income. It's totally excluded from the income that you have to declare to IRS. That means not only do you not have to pay federal income tax on it, you don't have to pay Social Security tax on it. You don't have to pay state income tax on it. And above all, the break you're getting is not your overall tax rate. Suppose that's 15%. The break you're getting is your marginal tax bracket from that exclusion, which may be 25%. Now, if you take the 25% and you add to it the savings from Social Security, that's 5% right there, 6%. And the state income tax break, the final conclusion is that overall, the tax deductions we give for premiums and for care amount to a 35 to 40% discount on health care. In other words, the government is discounting health, the cost of health care to you, even in the form of premiums, by 35 to 40%. Now, if that's the case, I mean, these statistics, that statistic is relatively undisputable. What that means is that if you have a choice of telling your employer, give me better health care as a fringe benefit, and don't give me as much of an increase in wages, or give me the increase in wages and keep the healthcare system plan the way it is, so that I can then spend the extra wages on extra income on other things in the economy, other things in my life. The whole choice is loaded. You're getting a 35 to 40% break on the former choice, if you make the former choice. Every dollar you take home as wages instead of putting it into the better health plan is really 35 cents of that dollar that you would take home instead of having the better health plan is just taken away because you don't have tax break on it. Unless the things you spend it on are also get tax breaks. That would be a possibility. But that's why, in fact, unions have bargained first for very good health plans. So the tax system has had a lot to do with it. Now, some people argue, I think it's somewhat questionable though, some people argue that this is a system which benefits the wealthy or the middle class and doesn't benefit the poor, because the poor don't gain much by tax exclusions or tax deductions. They're in such a low bracket already. To be sure, I think finally that claim might be justified, that charge might be justified. It is somewhat questionable, though, just intuitively, because the point of the tax break system we have for healthcare is that if you happen to have to spend $10,000 on healthcare one year and you only earn $20,000, you didn't really have a $20,000 income. You really had only a $10,000 income, because the $10,000 you spent on healthcare was just a necessity which got drained off immediately. And so you should only be taxed on $10,000. And if, by contrast, a $10,000 person, or also if a $10,000 person had $10,000, say, had a $500 bill that year, that person should be taxed on $9,500. So the person who earns $10,000 and has a $500 medical bill should have just about the same taxable income as the $20,000 income person with a $10,000 medical bill. That's simply because what medical bills do is cancel out income. They are not consumption. They are not what we choose to spend. They cancel out income. That's the rationale for the tax breaks. It may be a good rationale. The problem with it is middle class and wealthy people just do spend a lot more of that money on health care than poor people do. Not always just because they want to, but because of a whole bunch of other considerations in the system, like availability of care, et cetera. And so I think you could finally make good the charge that the whole tax system benefits the middle class and the wealthy a lot more than it benefits the poor. Tax breaks are another cause. Finally, a fourth cause of the rise in healthcare costs is lack of competition. Employers, very few employers, give people a really stark choice about how to spend their money on health insurance premiums. What they should do to create competition in the healthcare sector is make sure that the employer pays no more for any one plan that an employee may choose than any other plan that employee may choose. That's the first thing that would have to be done. So that if you bought an expensive plan instead of a cheap plan, it comes out of your pocket. That's what ought to be the case. Secondly, the employer must give you some choice. And choice means meaningful choice. Not two plans that are similar. Three plans that are very different. That's what it means. But in some communities, you don't even have three plans that are very different. The upshot of it is, you don't have much competition in the healthcare sector. Some people, a number of economists and business analysts, some of whom have very much gotten the ear of people in the Reagan administration, are now proposing as a major strategy to keep down costs, increasing competition in the healthcare economy. Regardless of whether you think that is in the end going to work, and there's some reasons why one might think it won't work, it is, I think, better than the present system. The first thing we ought to do is get competition within the healthcare sector. It's relatively easy to get by some fairly simple regulations. I don't say simple, I would say fairly simple, at least in relation to other regulations we might have to control costs. Well, the point of all of looking at these causes in the rise of healthcare is this. The structure of the way we pay for healthcare. Insurance, cost reimbursement is the method insurers use to pay. Hospitals say, tax breaks, and the lack of competition. It's the structure that is bound, absolutely bound, to generate the use of non-cost-worthy care. That is, care that, though it has some benefits, is not worth the money it costs. The structure of the system is bound to generate that. This will, I claim, be particularly costly and exploitative to the poor. It's more costly and exploitative to them than it is to others, though it's exploitative of all. Now, if in fact people decide that the benefits of the present system, the benefits of a system with the tax breaks, benefits of a highly insured system, and the benefits of not having competition between providers of health care somehow are worth it. They have benefits too. Clearly insurance does. I'm not sure what the other ones have. Then we might decide that the rise in cost is worth it, even though it seems to generate crazy decisions like the one about the six test series of tests of stool for cancer. We might decide that overall it's still worth it to have that system, but I would think that we ought to explore a lot of other options first. Now, if we're going to try to restrain costs, and if we're going to create competition, or if we're going to have any other kind of regulation to help restrain costs, one of the questions we eventually just must face, we won't get there's a certain kind of control of costs that we won't get without asking the question, is what is the price of life? Now, if after this discussion or description of the rising health, of rising medical costs, you were to say, well, adding a slight medical benefit, even at exorbitant cost, is worth it, simply worth it, because life has no price. You're out of the problem. You wouldn't be concerned about it. This whole business of rising medical costs, as long as it doesn't involve inefficiency, wouldn't concern you. But I think the fact that it does concern us very clearly points us in the direction that we should consider, namely that life does have a price. So then we get into the price of life debate. Now, that's something that is very close to the hearts of people in the Christian tradition, because, among other things, life is a gift of God, and it apparently is somehow callous and insulting to that gift try to put any monetary value on it. As the quip has been made, economists know the price of everything and the value of nothing. And especially when you come to life, you should just wipe out all these economic considerations for thinking that the amount of money we're putting into the healthcare system is an abuse of us, or an abuse of the poor, or an aggrandizement of healthcare providers, or whatever. And that's a serious question. It's raised in other areas by, it was raised by John Schramm in quoting early last week, in quoting a section that from one of the writings of Thomas Merton, whom he gave a talk on, in a delightful essay called The Rain and the Rhinoceros. Let me just make a plug for that book. I've read a couple chapters of it this week, and it really is delightful. Thomas Merton, M-E-R-T-O-N, a book called Raids on the Unspeakable. This man has a gift for phrases. Raids on the Unspeakable. In it, an essay, I'll read just a paragraph from, called Rain and the Rhinoceros. The rhinoceros is the person charging ahead with life, always doing the useful things and only the useful thing, blinding him or herself to everything else. The essay begins with this quotation. "Let me say this before rain becomes a utility that they can plan and distribute for money. By they, I mean the people who can understand, who cannot understand that rain is a festival." Think of life as a gift by comparison, but as a parallel. "Who do not appreciate its gratuity, who think that what has no price has no value, that what cannot be sold is not real, so that the only way to make something actual is to place it on the market. The time will come when they will sell you even your rain. At the moment it is still free, and I am in it. I celebrate its gratuity. I celebrate its meaninglessness." Now, if life is the same sort of thing, then we shouldn't be concerned about the whole business of some healthcare being what I call non-costly, not worth the money we pay for, even if it's efficiently delivered. Well, I think there are some very serious mistakes in extending that, as appropriate as it is, I completely agree with it in the case of rain, to healthcare. The reasons are that healthcare is not of unlimited supply, like rain, or relatively unlimited supply. There is large demand for it in some areas, not in the case of rain, but in some areas of the economy. You get something that only a few people like, and if nobody else makes any demand for it, it has no price, even if it's quite limited in supply. But healthcare isn't that way. There's a huge demand for it. There's a limited supply of it because we've got limited resources which we can use to spend on creating healthcare. There's a large demand for it, and further of all, we can control its delivery, unlike rain. Now, maybe all that's unfortunate. Maybe it'd be great if there wasn't a very large demand for healthcare, there was an unlimited supply of it, and we couldn't control it, its delivery. If that were the case, it'd be like rain, and we shouldn't try to economize it and monetize it. But since it's none of those things, I think it inevitably just does have a price. Anything that is of limited supply, for which there is a large demand, and the delivery of which we can control, is going to have a price. And to say it doesn't have a price is to say we are unwilling to accept our status as free individuals who have to make choices about what we do with resources in life. God-given resources. So there is nothing, in fact, undignifying, I would claim, at all about putting a price. $1 million for life saved, so that the fourth test in that six test series of tests for colon, intestinal cancer, cancer of the colon, is cost worthy, or should it be $500,000 per life saved, in which you got to dip down to the second test in the series before you get to the cost worthy level? Now, most of these decisions, if we ever did get some way of thinking about the price of life, would not be made at the point when life is on the line. You don't use the price of life, if in fact it has one, to say to a person who's right there in the hospital bed and may need a particular kind of test to reduce a certain risk of a mistaken diagnosis or whatever. You don't say at that point, "Well, Charlie, this is going to compute out to $1.5 million per life saved, so we're not going to give it to you." No, you do all this beforehand. This is why I called this whole discussion, this whole series, a question of considerations of policy. We're talking about policies. Now, these policies are made. We can, as a human community, make choices about what kind of care to deliver, even if it may be developed. We might decide it's too cost-worthy to deliver it. We can make decisions about what kind of care to develop it if we guess that when we did develop it, it would be too cost-worthy. We could even decide not to research the possibility of care because we thought the results would quite certainly be too costly. Now, of course, at that initial stage, it seems kind of foolish because we don't know what we're going to come up with. So we plow ahead with the research, and I would in general think that the price of life, if we put a ceiling on the price of life, that would not engender many implications at all for what money we should spend on research, but it will generate a lot of implications for what care we should finally deliver and how we should organize the delivery system. Okay, so we're back to the price of life discussion. Can we come up with any meaningful model for putting a price on life? One model that's been talked about a lot, it's actually the only one that's been used in great detail by some of the policy analysts, is, I think, disgusting. It's the human capital model. And it assesses the value of a life saved by the earnings foregone in that person's dying. So if a person dies at 30 and they're going to earn an average of $25,000 a year in the remaining 35 years of their life, that computes out to, you know, $1 million. And you add interest and all that. You discount for interest because some of that is coming later. And it comes out to be $1 million or something like that. And so if, in fact, the health care you're delivering is on the average saving 30-year-olds and they're on the average going to earn that much money, you really ought to deliver it, even though it computes out to, its costs compute out to $1 million per life saved. Well, what that means, obviously, is that if a particular disease or health problem afflicts primarily 65-year-olds instead of 30-year-olds, you as a society would decide not to deliver the care. Now, in general, I think we can make a case that it's more important to save young lives before older lives. That's a very touchy discussion. It's not just touchy to people, it's touchy intellectually. It's a thorny issue. I think in general I would want to say that we should spend more on saving young lives than old. Maybe not very young ones, but certainly the ones that are along the way. But clearly the human capital model is still mistaken, because there isn't some big break at 65 in the value of people's lives. There isn't some big break in the value of life depending on how much you earn. So that one goes down the tube. Another model that's been proposed, but it is much more difficult to apply, much, much more difficult indeed to apply, is the model called willingness to pay. And I think this is the one that is on very firm ground, theoretically, and the only problems are the practical problems of coming up with the data and then knowing where and when to apply them. Willingness to pay says, if a person is willing to pay, say, $50, to eliminate a 1 in 1,000 chance of death. Let us suppose riding without a seatbelt has a 1 in 1,000 chance of killing you in a given year. And with the seatbelt, you eliminate that risk. That's oversimplifying the problem a lot already. Just suppose that. If you are willing to pay $50 but not willing to pay $100, what that means is the value of life for you in that choice is at least $50,000, 50 times 1,000. And the way you get that figure is you imagine 1,000 people deciding to have seatbelts. If they all contributed $50,000, $50, they could distribute seatbelts to people, have the plant that would manufacture them, etc., for $50, distribute them to people, and as a result in that year, it's very, very likely, the probabilities are, that you'd save one life. But you would have gotten $50,000 that people would have contributed, and by it, you would have saved one life. So that means that each person puts a $50,000 valuation on life, it appeared. Now, this works very nicely for decisions which are just reduction in low-risk decisions. It doesn't work very nicely if you're faced with a 90% chance of dying. You can remove all of that risk of dying, and you're asked how much you'd be willing to pay to reduce all of that 90% risk of dying. It doesn't work very well. Still, what I would claim is that, in the last analysis, is that it does work. We, even in that situation, would not want to spend $5 million on our lives. Even if we had it, we wouldn't want to spend it. Because we would see that that would be indulging ourselves, given the other needs in life, especially the needs of other people. So there is a limit on what people are willing to pay, and I think should be willing to pay, even in very high-risk situations. Though, immediately, we can see, of course, that it seems that the value of life varies from low-risk to high-risk situations. In a low-risk situation, the value of life that people, that is computed out of their willingness to pay, may be as low as $50,000. In high-risk situations, it may be $1.5 million. It could be very high indeed in high-risk situations. Okay. Now, let us note that that does not make the whole willingness to pay model for pricing lies irrelevant. In medicine, we may think of medicine as often dealing with 90% chances of dying, and so we say, well, gee, you're talking about $1.5 million per life saved as an implied valuation if you're thinking in terms of willingness to pay. No, you're not thinking in terms of valuations nearly that high, because most medical procedures do not reduce that 90% risk to zero. They reduce the 90% risk to 60. So you're only talking about a 30% change. Or they may reduce that 90% risk to 89. And they still may seem to be very important decisions made under urgent circumstances, etc. That's often what a CAT scan is. Since usually when a CAT scan is done, it doesn't pick up anything. So you're talking about reducing a 90% chance of dying to an 89% chance. At the time you choose the care, or somebody chooses the care for you, that's the reduction you're talking about. So if you're only talking about a 1% reduction in risk, you ought to use the 1% context, not the 90% context, because that's what the change is. Now, there's still some complications in that. But at any rate, I would claim that the clear implications of this model in generating prices of life in low-risk situations and the apparently problematic character of it in generating prices of life in high-risk situations doesn't mean that it's not applicable to medical care. It is still applicable to medical care, because a lot of medical care doesn't reduce that 90% risk to zero or anything close to it. Now, notice that the complications or the reason for saying that. One of the reasons for saying that is often overlooked. Suppose you do the CAT scan. No, that's not a particularly good example. Suppose you do a heart operation, a bypass surgery, and you live. Does that show you've reduced the 75% risk of dying to zero? No, you still got a certain mortality with the bypass operation, number one. Number two, we have difficulty sometimes knowing whether it's the bypass operation or something else that made the difference. Actually, excuse me, let me change examples. A better example would be intensive coronary care units. In terms of medical facts, a much better example would be an intensive coronary care unit. A person gets put in an intensive coronary care unit when they have a heart attack. They live instead of dying. Statistically, it seems they had a 60% chance of dying when they went in to that intensive coronary care unit. Should we attribute to the intensive coronary care unit a reduction in the risk of death from 60 to zero? No. They might have lived even if they weren't in an intensive coronary care unit. And in fact, the studies show that the reduction isn't anything like 60 to zero. Of the people who went in intensive coronary care unit, 60% live. Of the people who, like people, not people in less serious heart attacks, though it's difficult to control for this in the study, 40% live. So there's really only a 20% reduction. In fact, one study showed that you're better off, on the average, being at home than in an intensive coronary care unit. To the tune of $700 a day. So it still is applicable to the medical care system. Well, I won't go into other problems with that willingness to pay method for pricing life. I do think it's plausible. I think it has a lot of details to be worked out. I think it can be used at the policy level. The major problem, which I'll get to Wednesday in relation to the poor, aid for the poor, is the objection to that model, which says it can't possibly be correct because it means that the value of a life for a poor person is lower than the value of a life for a rich person, since the willingness to pay will be different in the two cases. Therefore, we ought to throw the model out right at the beginning, just as definitively as we threw out the human capital model. What I'll argue at the beginning of Wednesday's discussion is that that argument is mistaken, that in fact the monetary value of a poor person's life in a certain sense, we have to be very careful what that sense is lower than the monetary value of a rich person's life. That's controversial. And I'll claim that in fact respect for poor people demands it, which is the counterintuitive claim. And that will add to the substance of the critique of the medical care system, which says the medical care system is exploiting the poor, though it may not be exploiting the middle class. Sorry I've gone this long, but this was an overview and I was trying to hit a whole bunch of things about the system. Dave?
I have a couple points on rising cost of health care. Are malpractices a very significant factor in what's driving up medical charges, or physician charges?
The highest figure I've seen in print on that is 11%. 11% of the increase in a given year in the total aggregate cost of healthcare in the economy could be contributed by the need to avoid malpractices. That's the top end I've seen in print. Some people say it's canceled out by a whole bunch of other considerations and it's really about 1%.
I'm wondering also about...
it's not nearly as important as the insurance phenomenon.
I'm wondering also about efficiency. And there's increased professionalization in healthcare, division of labor, and so on. Little or no opportunity for patient or family labor, for example, in a hospital situation where some of the needs might be attended to by family members who are in a nursing staff. Would that be part of an efficiency, or like,
yes.
Not really efficiency necessarily, you might have improved efficiency due to the professionalization bring in higher costs?
Specialization has, and increased division of labor has, perhaps added to inefficiencies. It has also clearly added to the provision of care with increased cost, even though the benefits are getting very small. But of course, there are good reasons for wanting specialization, since we want to be attended by a specialist in it when we're really, really sick. So I don't want to paint this as a, I want to leave these questions open. I don't want to paint this as a situation in which we clearly are spending too much on healthcare. I think we just simply have to, what we have to get to at this point in our political and economic life, cultural life, is asking the question and trying to get some ways of handling it. Are we spending too much on healthcare? And specialization has contributed to the provision of care with relatively small benefits that also cost a lot.
I guess when I think about medical care, it's very similar to a lot of other, not only industries, but political situations, in that today things are much more interrelated than they were, say, even 20 years ago, but specifically, you know, maybe 100 or 150 years ago. And there's a lot more issues involved. For example, what is it, like 90% of the scientists that have ever been alive are alive today. Okay, so with, like you were talking about before, the increased specialization, there's more people getting their fingers into the pie, you know, and everybody's got to get their share of the pie. And like we were talking about a little bit with the co-ops, until certain people are willing to make those sacrifices, the sacrifice that, well, I'm not going to pay for the intensive coronary care unit I want. I don't know what the alternative to that would be, but I specify that I want that and I'm willing to take the chance that I'm going to die if I have a heart attack and don't get that extra care. It's just like anything else, I think. It's going to take certain people to make those sacrifices in order to bring about some sort of an equilibrium level, because so many people, it gets so big and so massive, it creates its own equilibrium. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy almost. You know, the more people you get involved, and just like, you know, the political thing now where so many countries are much more interrelated, it's so much more difficult to make a decision and say, okay, we're going to drop a bomb here, we're going to drop a bomb there, because of the far-reaching effects You know, if you say, in the medical field, if you say, okay, we're going to cut out this machine because it's too expensive, your marginal benefits are less than the marginal cost. Well, there's so many people that that affects on down the line indirectly that aren't even related to the medical field. Maybe people that work for the corporations in a different, they work for the corporation, but in a different division that produces that machine, and it affects the profit structure of the company. You know, it's so interrelated with other portions of the economy.
If we had a really competitive healthcare system in which people finally made free market choices, knowledgeable, you got a whole problem there because our patients, subscribers, knowledgeable about medical matters. If you had that, I would rather give the choice about what's worth the money to the subscriber and the consumer. But as a matter of fact, we're missing some very important elements in that right at the beginning in any healthcare delivery system. And therefore, some of those choices are eventually just going to get back. They're either going to get back to policymakers or they're just not going to be made. I think presently we're largely just not making them. And the question is, do we give them somehow to policymakers, or do we do part of it by increasing competition, or how do we get at them? There's some control here. Dale?
Is there any way to estimate what the price of life is currently with our current system?
Oh, yes.
I find the question interesting, but how do I relate it to what's actually happening?
Well, you'd have to ask for what care, at what margin. The basic care, doing appendicitis operation, or having CAT scans. I mean, and it just varies all over the map. The present price we put on life, as indicated by having this procedure or service in our health.
Is there an advantage of the maximum that insurance companies would pay?
Insurance companies don't even consider. No, insurance companies don't consider.
Estimating some of that.
No, if it's considered good medical care by medicine, then insurance companies cover it. But I mean, that's how they get to a decision to cover it. They may initially not cover it because they think it might be abused or something like that, but it's those considerations. Does it have some proven medical benefit that get them to cover it? They basically stay out of the cost business. The cost consideration business. And that's to their advantage. They may lose out a little bit temporarily because their premiums can't be kept quite as low in competition with a competing insurance company, but all insurance companies gain in the long run by spending more money on healthcare in society. They gain a lot. So insurance companies don't have much incentive to hold down.
So the question you're raising is, what degree of medical care is reasonable to provide?
That's right.
That the economy
Sir.
Can afford.
So if life has no price, we should set no limits on what is the amount of money that's still a good bargain to spend on medical care. But if life does have a price, then there should be some limits.
That's one of the things that I see wrong with society today is in medical care, at least, is that people expect they almost demand that it will be there for them. The cost is no objective. Somebody owes me something because I take up this space. And I think that that's something that society needs to change their thinking on.
People can band together in a plan that says, you can't just come in the door and get what you want.
It's a little more complicated than just saying that.
Yeah, but that's what has to be done. Yes?
How much are other societies willing to pay in terms of the gross national product?
We're spending close to 10. Britain has a lower GNP per capita to begin with, considerably lower, so that they end up spending less or just about one-third real dollars on health care what we spend. One-third. Excuse me, I forgot to use that example.
Yeah, but you have to wouldn't think things like how long it takes to get your tonsils up, too.
Okay, but just think about the poor. Think about the poor. About the poor. Wouldn't it be better if you were a poor person to live in Britain and have 67% of the American healthcare dollar left over to spend on other things than to live in the United States?
There's no proof that their system gives the poor a little better than ours.
Oh, I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying there's a certain very restrictive, there's a restrictive system, Britain's, which if we could overcome certain other problems in it, would be a better buy for the poor in our society than our system is, even though it's clearly not as good medical care.
The other thing that people don't really generally, in my experience, really talk and discuss medical care as being too high priced. And it seems that most people really, you know, they don't really care. You know, it's not high. It's half the medical care they're getting, et cetera. It'd be interesting to know what people here think what the medical care they're getting.
Okay, sure. Overall, it might not be too high, because if we try to compute out the average of what a life saved by the medical care system costs, it might appear to be a very good buy. But we have choices not just about having it all or having nothing. We have choices about the margins. And it may be that on the margin we're spending too much. It may be. I just want to say that's an important question.
It may be.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just a question of the Senate to increase it. A lot of people, most people are not concerned, well then you're not going to get much pressure to bring it into a more competitive situation.
Because so many people have available to them the private sector. So they don't have it.
At no direct cost to themselves.
But if you belong to an HMO, then you have some incentive because it costs you money out of your pocket to get something.
No more. In fact, it doesn't cost you anything because they don't have deductibles, HMOs.
They still have costs that they have to put up.
But any point. Sweden is spending over 12% of its GNP on healthcare, and its GNP per capita is higher now than ours. So, and one of the reasons the economists tell us is they're more highly insured than we are and have been for a long time. So they're, what? Yeah, right. Right. But the problem, I mean, they're beginning to ask the problem too, and probably will be asking it even more severely than we are.